Welcome, everyone, to Politics and Polls. This is the podcast of the Woodrow Wilson School, and I'm Professor Sam Wong, a professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, and also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. Julian Zelizer is away, and so I'm who you get today. I'm very pleased to welcome our guest today. We are welcoming Professor Jed Sugarman, who teaches at Fordham Law. Professor Sugarman has a BA, JD, and a PhD in American history from Yale University. And today he's here to talk about the Mueller investigation, Jared Kushner, matters having to do with Russia, and matters having to do with the Constitution. He is the author of The People's Courts, Pursuing Judicial Independence in America 2012, published a few years ago, on the evolution of judicial elections and politics in America. He's currently working on an anti-corruption emoluments lawsuit against the Trump administration, and he's writing about American prosecutors and the design of the federal executive. He writes about law and politics at sugarblog.com, and I'll spell that for you, S-H-U-G-E-R, blog. .com. And he's written for Slate Magazine. He's written for, he's gotten interviewed by many media outlets. He's become rapidly one of the inside go-to people who has been following closely the legal ins and outs of what's happening with the Mueller investigation. So, Jed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's great to talk to you, Sam.
Yeah, so let's back up a little bit. And I realize that this is going to sound funny, but under normal circumstances, something like the Mueller investigation would be front and center, and we would all be riveted. But we're not in normal circumstances, and so there's all this other stuff like, I don't know, Stormy Daniels or whatever, other things are happening in the news that seem to distract us. So let's just start with kind of something very basic, which is how far has the Mueller investigation come from the beginning, and what are the focuses of the investigation now in terms of, you know, whatever it might be, Kushner, Cutter, or what have you?
That's a great question, because there are so many different strands of this investigation as we learn more. But we're also learning very little from Mueller. His team has been professional, and they've been very careful not to leak from their end. So we're getting leaks from other sources, and those sources have their own agendas one way or the other. So I say the simplest way to break down the investigation is into three parts. One part is what we call the collusion case itself, about what was the interactions and arrangements between the Trump campaign and Russia. Then the second part actually precedes that, because it opens up the door to the question of financial improprieties, financial crimes before the campaign. And one example of that is Manafort and Rick Gates. Most of the indictment, almost the entire indictment, precedes 2016 for Manafort and Gates's guilty plea. But that sets up the background for what might have influenced the first part, the core investigation about Russian collusion. And then the third piece is obstruction of justice, things that postdate the campaign itself, but based on Trump's and his associates' activities once in office.
So often one talks about the cover-up being worse than the crime, but in this case, we're talking about two fairly serious matters, collusion with Russia and financial improprieties, and then an attempted cover-up or an attempted way to thwart investigation. So it's, in this case, I don't know, the first two things sound kind of serious to me.
Yeah, they are serious. They're very serious. In terms of one update is that the judge who is supervising Manafort's prosecution, and he's being prosecuted in two different jurisdictions. One of the judges has just weighed in, giving in terms of the calendar and in terms of advice to Manafort, and said to Manafort that the case against you is quote unquote strong, and you're facing 304 years in prison. And so that judge. Judges don't always do that, weigh in that heavily, and it's often to try and move a case forward. But that's an indication of the seriousness of just one piece of that of this investigation for Manafort.
And what would be the reason for saying that? Would it be to get Manafort to go along with to move the trial fast, or to strike a plea deal? Like, why would a judge ever do that?
Well, sometimes in a regular case, a judge wants to be helpful to the parties, right? So if a judge who's looking at, let's say, a naive and unsophisticated defendant, if the judge sees that the case is a slam dunk, but the defendant is wants to go to trial, a judge might be helpful to a defendant in such a case by saying, you should really think twice about this. The plea bargain they're offering you is the best deal you're going to get. You should cooperate.
And what's the good outcome for Manafort? 304 years sounds bad. So what's the good outcome?
the good outcome is to look around and see what Mueller has done for other actors here. Rick Gates is pleading guilty to two charges, which could generate what some people say is likely to be 6 months in prison. Flynn, who is exposed to enormous criminal jeopardy, if he had not pleaded guilty, he's facing something similar, six months in prison for one charge. So Mueller is using, I would say Mueller is showing us that if you cooperate, he will give deals that are still convictions and still probably will generate jail time, but it's 6 months is less than 304 years. So the question for Manafort is will he cooperate and plead guilty to get something similar to those earlier guilty pleas?
It seems to me that this was an investigation that was supposed to be about Russian interference in elections. And here we are talking about financial misdeeds committed before the campaign. So in a sense, is that getting beyond the brief of what Mueller was supposed to be doing in the first place?
Well, that's the question of what Mueller's jurisdiction is confined to has come up before. That was that Manafort made this argument, or his lawyers made this argument, that that Mueller has an unconstitutional job. It goes beyond constitutional authority, and he's gone beyond his jurisdiction. The issue is that Rod Rosenstein is the acting attorney general, and as acting attorney general, he can increase the scope of the investigation. It's pretty clear that when Rosenstein has been appearing, he was there at various points before Congress and later, making it clear that Mueller has broad jurisdiction and that he approves of how Mueller's handling it. And then to signal that kind of unified team approach, he actually reported the indictment of 13 Russians who were involved with the trolling and the identity theft. So as a legal matter, that's how Mueller's investigation is appropriately expanding. The reason why this is so closely linked is because the question about the collusion and the work between Trump and Russia raises questions about why that collusion or coordination would have happened. And that raises the question of that drives this investigation. What might Putin or Russia have had as blackmail on as leverage on Trump and his associates? And if there are ample records of you know, millions and millions of dollars of money laundering and bank fraud in Gates and Manafort's background, that's one lever of blackmail to drive this kind of conspiracy. So that is part and parcel of the story of collusion.
So let me just make sure I understand this. So the line here is that Manafort and Gates are engaged in dirty business with Russia, including largely of a financial nature. They share with, say, the Trump campaign an interest in Russia. They get together. And so that backdrop is part of what drove the partnership between Manafort and the Trump campaign. And it's also a way that Mueller can get a lower down figure in this whole saga and then work his way up the chain. Is it something like that?
Yeah, that exactly. It's both the story and the legal the flipping, right? It is the context of how the coordination could have happened, what the interests of the parties, we try and figure out in a crime what someone's motive was. Well, Manafort in his background had huge debts, and he had been basically he had been an inner circle Republican operative in the 1980s, but he had gotten out of the game and had shifted overseas to make more money than he ever could have in America domestically, working in the Ukraine and working for Russian interests. But he had such huge debts that it wound up becoming more leverage. So that's part of the story of the Russian involvement. And there's even a question of whether Manafort was directed by Russian interests to make himself available for free for Trump, because that enabled more of this coordination.
Like they had him over a barrel and said, look, you can help us out by burrowing into the Trump campaign, something like that.
Exactly right. That's exactly right.
Now, let's talk about the difference between collusion, which I am a little bit vague on whether that's a crime, versus criminal conspiracy. How does one make the distinction there?
Great. So in order to convict someone of a crime, you need a statute. You need to have a law on the books that designates and defines a crime. There is no crime in any American statute of collusion. It's a colloquial word we use in this context. So the question of how to bring a criminal charge in this case is to find another statute. And then conspiracy law generally works as a conspiracy to commit some other defined statutory crime. So that is technically how Mueller is proceeding, is he is in each of these guilty pleas or each of these indictments, he finds a crime. But the larger question is, was there a conspiracy to commit some specific crime of, let's say, bank fraud or identity theft? And the other kinds of crimes we've looked at are computer hacking, right? That's also part of what the Russians were doing. Would all be conspiracies for crimes. But here's the interesting thing that's just unfolded in the last set of indictments is that there is an underlying crime of conspiracy that and it's an interesting legal theory that Mueller's using. So the basic idea.
And how do we know that this is his theory?
Because reading the indictment, he brings something called conspiracy against the United States. And initially, I was confused about what he was referring to. And it seemed just like rhetoric. That's like, you know, he'll have an indictment. It'll say, for example, in the first indictment against Manafort and Gates, there was something like a Roman numeral one. It said conspiracy against the United States. And when I saw that, I was confused because that seemed to be rhetoric more than law. But as another professor, Randall Eliason, has dug into this, and he says, look, there's a statute and an old case that says it's a conspiracy to defraud the United States that includes schemes to interfere with or obstruct one of the government's lawful functions by deceit, craft, or trickery, and it applied in a set of tax cases. And the idea here is that there is an independent conspiracy charge if one is interfering with something like the lawful conduct of elections. And that seems to be and there's a case from 100 years ago called Hammerschmidt that the Supreme Court spelled this out and said, yes, there is this independent conspiracy against the United States that's a valid criminal charge. And so I would predict that theory is going to unfold in more indictments. And in fact, Rick Gates, when he pleaded guilty to that crime, conspiracy against the United States. It sounds serious because it is serious.
I see. To me, this sounds fairly intuitive. The interfering with an American election, interfering with the practice of democracy, that seems like a reasonably intuitive case that attempting to do so would be a crime against the United States. So it seems like it might get traction in a court of law. Is there a reason to suspect it wouldn't?
Well, I mean, the key is the Supreme Court precedent of Hammerschmidt, and so that's what really gives this more solid support. And given how strong Mueller's team is, they've surely dug it. They're not going to go down some crazy theory, given that they have other ways of bringing these indictments and getting guilty pleas. That they've chosen this path is indicative of experts thinking this is solid.
I see, and so this seems like a principal driver that we're going to be learning more about in the, I presume, in the months ahead.
I'm learning a lot about this too.
Yeah. Now, the way you laid it out at the beginning, you said, okay, collusion, financial improprieties, and then obstruction of justice. But there's been a recent development that you've written about. You wrote about it in Slate on March 2nd about princeling Jared Kushner in Russia, and you wrote a piece that connected the dots between Kushner, a massive $184 million loan from somebody last November, the country of Qatar, the sale of the company Rosneft. Like, walk us through that. This seems like something that has been honestly under the radar of a lot of news coverage. Tell us about that.
Right. It's a big deal, and it relates. It really has to. It ties into all three pieces: collusion, financial crimes, and obstruction potentially. So the background is that we just learned about 2 weeks ago two pieces of a puzzle, and I'll explain. Let me take a step back. You know, one of the main pieces of the Steele dossier and its allegations.
The famous dossier.
famous dossier. You know, it's interesting how much step by step the dossier pieces of the dossier keep getting corroborated. And so one piece that I've been drawn to is a core claim that the Russians had set up, that Putin and his bankers set up a deal to sell 19% of the biggest Russian petrochemical company, Rosneft. And the deal they made in the summer of 2016, according to the dossier, was that they would take not they wouldn't give 19% of this massive corporation to Trump, but they would be able to use the commissions generated by the sale, which would be in millions of dollars, that would be very liquid and easy to move around and potentially launder, that they could move those millions of dollars to Trump people. So that was part of the quid pro quo, to give the Trump people something in exchange for lifting sanctions, which have been very crippling to the Russian oligarchs. So it turns out, step by step, various pieces have come together to show that deal it may have actually been executed. So the next step is that we know that in December of 2016, a month after the election, that Kushner was setting up this secret line with Flynn between the Russian embassy and the Kremlin, and then right in that moment with a series of interactions, that Rosneft indeed was sold. And in fact, 19% of Rosneft was sold to a Qatar firm that's backed by the government of Qatar. And Qatar promptly then sold those assets from Rosneft out into the market. Okay, so here's what's key about what happens next. Qatar then is involved with a major foreign policy blowup with the Saudis and other Gulf states. And we learned about 2 weeks ago that Kushner was behind allegedly the escalation of that conflict that was that reported at the time to be a march towards war, okay? And then 7 months later, Kushner gets a $184 million loan from a firm that's backed by Qatar. So when you put all of that together, what it appears happened, and this is an allegation and a suggestion, is that it seems like Qatar was designated to be the intermediary in the sale of Rosneft and then delivering the commissions to Trump and or Kushner. They may have gotten cold feet in the middle of that deal once the Steele dossier was published, because they bought the deal to buy Rosneft happened. Then the Steele dossier was published. They then rejected Kushner's effort to get them to bail out his massive real estate disaster in New York City.
Why does he have so much debt? What's going on there?
Yeah. So let me take that. That's a huge piece of the story.
Okay, right.
I'll tell this as briefly as I can. You know, Kushner has been trying to make his name in real estate. He comes from a family in real estate, and he saw an opportunity to redeem his family name and build his own empire in the model of Trump when a building which this is remarkable. The address of the building is 666 Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, that's good.
And at the time, it was the largest real estate purchase in New York history for $1.8 billion. And journalists have basically written about what a disastrous deal this was. That number one, it came in 2008 at the height of the real estate market, just before the crash. So he paid top dollar and got burned. But second of all, this building was never worth anything like that. People said this building actually needs to be gutted or torn down if you want to make it usable in the 21st century. So then he had to find a bailout, and he sought a bailout from the Chinese. They then, when journalists got a hold of it, the Chinese backed away because it was getting scrutiny on whether that was inappropriate. Then Qatar backed away when Kushner tried to get them to bail him out, and he also is over a barrel because he owes something like $500 million in a balloon payment next year. He is desperate to find money and in order to avoid what seems to be bankruptcy.
And so, yeah, okay, so let's now fast forward just a little bit. Precipitating an international crisis, threatening Qatar with war, And then Qatar delivers $184 million to Jared Kushner. So describe to me what the crime is here.
Great. So the crime generally, right, is has underlying issues, right? There are various moments that are criminal. So not reporting these kinds of contacts when you go into government is a crime, right? So not false statements about these contacts. That itself is a crime. There are problems of money laundering. This is also bribery, quid pro quo. Basically extorting from a country, saying we're going to threaten you with a blockade. And with either military or finance or sanctions, unless you give me $184 million, that is the crime of bribery. But I'd say there's a long list that's possible, but I'd say there's a core set of crimes that are right there. If this is true, again, I'm saying these are implications and allegations, but that's certainly something that Mueller would be interested in.
Do we have evidence that he's going after this particular thread?
The possible evidence is that he is looking that Mueller has sought information from Qatar. And it's interesting, this was reported just a couple days ago, that Qatar is not cooperating. He's trying to withhold this information from Mueller. And I imagine that's what he's looking at. And it also then underscores the threat here is that if various countries like Russia and Qatar have evidence of crimes committed by Kushner and others, then they have leverage over the U.S. government and U.S. foreign policy.
There's some part of me that says that this is some kind of insane speculation by paranoid people. But yet in 2016, right, in BuzzFeed publishing that Steele dossier in January 10th, 2017, and now all these little things leaking out that appear to corroborate various aspects of it makes me suspect that maybe it's not crazy fever dream of the left.
I'll tell you two things. One is when I drafted this piece and sent it over to the editors at Slate, I asked them to first fact check everything I was citing. And I said, please help be my reality check as well. Tell me if you think that if this appears to be tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theory. And they read it, did all the fact checking, and they said, no, it is crazy. But that's because 2018 is crazy. Everything I just told you has been in the public domain and is not based on some kind of inside anonymous sourcing.
I mean, to some extent, that's also true of the Steele dossier itself. Like Jane Mayer wrote a thing in the New Yorker about Steele and about walking through his involvement in uncovering information and exactly his credentials and his bona fides.
Right, absolutely.
So speaking of Slate, there is a series of articles that you've written for Slate that I wanted to get into a little bit. And I wanted to find out to what extent this was speculative and to what extent this is well-grounded. You've written about how Mueller has a legal strategy to neutralize President Trump's power of pardon and also the possibility that he could fire Mueller or Rosenstein. So let's talk about that a little bit. How could, if the president can pardon people, doesn't that give him an ultimate get out of jail free card? But
that is kind of what the fear is, right? That he could use pardons and firings to avoid criminal liability and stay out of avoid jail, get out of jail, and stay out of jail. And so here's the bottom line. The point is that the presidential pardon power only applies to federal crimes. So what I've been showing is that there are a number of state crimes that are implicated by these investigations. I've emphasized New York State because we already have had reports from last summer that Mueller has been coordinating directly with Attorney General Eric Schneiderman of New York and his office. And so when I saw that report, what I was writing about before that was the idea that there was still state prosecutors could do the job that Mueller might not be able to do if there are broad pardons. And secondly, even if Trump were to fire Mueller, that you'd still have state prosecutors on the task, and Mueller could in fact be hired by a state government, state prosecutors, or an attorney general to continue his investigation and bring along his same team. So that's the big picture of how, you know, one of the great things about federalism is that you have states as backups when the federal government breaks down or the federal government gets out of control.
Would Mueller be under ethical obligations to not use knowledge he gained working for the federal government in pursuing that prosecution, or are there rules about that?
Yeah, there are rules, and I've been actually working on a post about this, because it turns out it is common for federal and state prosecutors to coordinate, especially when they're working on organized crime prosecutions. So you have, because you have overlapping jurisdiction, federal and state, you have federal and state prosecutors who independently find out about certain crimes, start investigating, and then team up. So this happens all the time, and the rules actually promote. You know, there are rules about when and how this can happen, but those rules would apply to approve of coordination in a situation like this. And they can not only work together in strategy, but they can share documents and evidence. I think it's likely that Mueller has already been sharing his information with state prosecutors because of this concern.
And why have we not heard from those state prosecutors? Why is that not in the news?
Well, we did hear over the summer that Mueller and Schneiderman were in conversation and were coordinating already. That was a pretty significant news break, 8 months ago. But just like Mueller's team is being very quiet, careful. I think that they've probably chosen maybe just one. It's possible that they're only working with Schneiderman himself, or Schneiderman and just a couple of members of his inner circle.
Let me take another whack at the issue of pardons. And I want to bring up a case that's known to legal scholars, that of Burdick. And I want to know about whether the acceptance of a pardon is an admission of guilt. So if I'm Kushner or Manafort or whoever, and I accept a pardon, is that admitting guilt to a crime?
Yeah, there's a huge debate about this. I think that the problem is that this is one Supreme Court case with language that points in that direction. But think about how many pardons. I mean, think about how we have DNA evidence today that has made it clear that someone on death row or someone convicted of murder is actually innocent. And then the governor will come up and say and will pardon that person of the crime of murder. And then prisoner accepts the pardon. That's the opposite of assuming guilt. So it can't be true that a pardon legally is the admission of guilt, or we've been misusing pardons for decades, or been misunderstanding them. So I'm on the side that says a pardon is not an admission of guilt in any way.
Okay, so you don't think there's any jeopardy that accrues to accepting a pardon?
So the argument, some have said if Kushner accepts a pardon, that could be used as evidence against him in a criminal state prosecution. And I'm of the opinion that it should be that the acceptance of that pardon should be inadmissible.
Let me talk about something that you've brought up as a possibility. You've taken a somewhat, in your writings for Slate and also on sugarblog.com, you've taken a somewhat expansive view of what kinds of things could be brought. It's sort of a little creative writing class in crimes that could be committed. No, I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way, but, you know, you're feeling the edges of the box, not necessarily going outside the box. And you've said you've written a proposal on state attorneys general to investigate the Trump Organization's financial dealings through an old common law power. And I want to hear about that a little bit.
Oh, sure. I mean, this was much more relevant before Mueller was appointed special counsel, because the problem we were facing was that when the Department of Justice was run by Jeff Sessions and there was no special counsel, there was no one to investigate these allegations. And so what I did is I shifted around in thinking that instead of it being the job of a federal prosecutor, what role could state prosecutors have, or state attorneys general? And so it turns out this is where legal history came in helpful. I just knew that there were a bunch of old powers called writs, W-R-I-T, from England. And I just started poking around these old writs, and I stumbled onto a fact I didn't know, which was that there was an – I knew about this power of quoeranto from England. Turns out almost every state in the country has this power. And what that power is for a state attorney general to investigate wrongdoing by a corporation and to then get information and then potentially, among other things, be able to dissolve that corporation if there's been a pattern of illegal practice. And so what I was suggesting was using again federalism and state power to investigate a federal authority. And that would have opened the door to then investigating some of the core claims about financial records, financial improprieties, what kinds of loans or debts the Trump organization had towards foreign sources that could have been used as leverage. And that was my angle for how to resolve this problem. It turns out that I think Mueller is probably sufficient, but as a backup, if Mueller were to be fired, what I'm saying is that this is in the toolbox that state prosecutors have to back up, to be the backup for Mueller if he's fired.
I see. In case of emergency, break glass.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So one thing I'm curious about is all of this sounds like, in some sense, a normal intellectual gaming out of how prosecutions go, how FBI investigations go, and so on. Do we have evidence that either Trump himself or the lawyers around him are cognizant of these steps and are playing the same chess game that you're describing?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, one hint that we have how seriously they take Mueller in the investigation is that the one central actor of 2017 or 2018 that Trump has not tweeted about, it seems like it's only Mueller, right? Mueller is... someone Trump does not attack and takes and seems to indicate that he is he's either understands Mueller's power or has been told to stay away. So that's interesting.
Wait, are you serious? He's never tweeted about Mueller?
I don't think he's ever used the name Mueller.
Wow, that's insane.
That's insane.
I don't think he's ever, you know, it's not little Robert or, you know, think he's tweeted about Witch Hunt. You know, he's tweeted all that's come up, and Sessions, et cetera. But I don't think that he's ever either mentioned Mueller directly or indirectly.
Wow.
But you know, what we do know is that he reports have come out that he asked Don McGahn, his White House counsel, to fire Mueller, and McGahn allegedly refused. So it is something that Trump fears, but also partly because I think he sees the gravity of this investigation.
Well, considering that he was able to fire his Secretary of State through a tweet, presumably Trump could fire him himself. Isn't that true?
Well, so that's a legal debate. I mean, I think the question, because there are regulations about who has the power to fire Mueller, and it's supposed to be the attorney general. In this case, that acting attorney general with Sessions recused would be Rosenstein. So under the Department of Justice rules, only Rosenstein has the power to fire Mueller, and it can only be for, quote, good cause, which means, you know, it can't just be on a whim. On the other hand, there is a whole school of thought that the president has total or what's called unitary power over the executive branch. And it's under that theory that Trump could ignore or rescind that regulation and fire Mueller himself.
So under that theory, like, he could like walk over to the Department of Labor and go find a secretary and fire that person. Like,
yes.
Like that's the idea. So he is the executive branch. And so therefore he can do whatever the heck he pleases.
That's exactly right.
So let me, back out from the legal aspects to political questions having to do with impeachment. So, or having to do, I should say, not impeachment itself, but just the ways that this can become a political question. We just recently had a congressional election where a district in Pennsylvania, a gerrymandered district that Donald Trump won by 19 points, appears to be either a tie or close to a tie and won by the Democratic candidates. And so there's this massive swing in public opinion that's starting to become apparent. And that raises the possibility that Democrats will end up controlling the House of Representatives. So compared with what we've been seeing from the House Intelligence Committee, compared with the way this is unfolding now, what could happen next as the political landscape changes?
It's a huge question. I mean, I think that we've seen this brewing for a while, that the Democrats seem likely to take back the House, not just in the election in Pennsylvania 18 and Connor Lamb's win, but we also have seen a number of state legislative districts where what's consistent is something like a 10 to 20 point swing in favor of Democrats. So I think
the median swing this year in 2018 has been 23 points.
Yeah, it's enormous. So, I mean, I think it's not likely to be that big, because I think at a certain point, public opinion will realize that the Democrats will take back the House. And this is actually part of my theory about why Republicans won Congress in 2016, is because they all thought Hillary was going to win, and they divided their tickets. They divided their ballots. But so the point is, I think it's likely that we see significant majority, something like 20 or more seat majority in the House. And then it's likely to get the first stage of impeachment, which is not removal. So the question is, what's the likelihood of removal? And I have no predictions about that. I think watching the Republican Party's behavior over the last 16 months, it seems unlikely that no matter what we come up with, that the Senate will not reach the 2/3 majority needed to remove Trump, but who knows?
But to focus on the nuts and bolts of it without getting into political speculation, I guess what I was getting at was the question of whether information uncovered by Mueller and his investigators could then be used by the House, Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, good question. I mean, so there are two pieces there. I mean, I think that's likely. I think it's likely that Mueller will decide to issue a report rather than indict a sitting president.
Because some things are not crimes.
Right.
Something can be impeachable without being a violation of a statute.
That's exactly right. A high crime and misdemeanor as the basis for impeachment is not the same thing as a statutory crime. Some things are impeachable which are not crimes, and some crimes, like jaywalking, are not impeachable. But there's a second point I'm making, Sam, which is I think Mueller is unlikely to try and indict President Trump for two reasons. One is I actually think that a sitting president can't really be indicted except for in, let's say, a very extreme circumstance. And second of all, Mueller is too conservative with a small c to try and push that power when he has other options, such as writing a report to the House. So my guess is that he probably would write a report very similar to the Kenneth Starr's report in the Bill Clinton impeachment proceedings. But the other thing to keep in mind is that if the Democrats take back the House, you don't have Devin Nunes as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. You would have someone like Adam Schiff, and they would then use subpoenas and, like with Watergate, use open testimony to get out more facts, put more pressure on witnesses, and also use open hearings to get more public attention on this investigation.
Wow. My first political memory at my age was, in fact, the Watergate hearings. And so I'm fascinated at the thought of getting another dose of that. All right. Well, let's see. We are unfortunately out of time. And I just want to thank you, Jed, for joining us today. We've been hearing from Jed Sugarman, who's a law professor at Fordham University, at Fordham Law School, and he's been investigating law and politics, and he writes about law and politics at sugarblog.com, sugerblog.com, and he's been writing about the Mueller investigation, Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, Gates, and the whole gang. So thank you, Jed, for joining us today on Politics and Polls.
Sam, thank you for having me. It was great talking to you.
All right, goodbye, everyone, and we will look forward to next time here from Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.